things are being said and things are being implied and things are being threatened, the likes of which we really haven't heard before.
How real is the war of words with North Korea? It's Wednesday, September 27th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, differing stories in Myanmar. Global police gather in China. How tall is Mount Everest? Bathtub science and a visit to Little Pakistan. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says the United States seeks a peaceful resolution to escalating tensions with North Korea, despite Pyongyang's claim that a tweet by President Donald Trump on Monday was tantamount to a declaration of war. In New Delhi for talks with Indian officials about strengthening U.S.-India ties, Mattis said while the United States military presence on the Korean Peninsula is necessary to deter North Korea's threats, it also supports diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict peacefully. On Monday, President Donald Trump commented on Twitter that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's regime won't be around much longer if the North carried out its recent threats. Speaking to reporters near United Nations headquarters in New York, North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho said given the fact that this comes from someone who is currently holding the seat of the United States presidency, this is clearly a declaration of war. How much importance should be put on this war of words? That's what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Evans Revere, senior advocate of the Albright Stonebridge Group and a former senior U.S. diplomat.
I don't think too much is being made of this escalating rhetoric. We're in a serious situation right now in which things are being said and things are being implied and things are being threatened, the likes of which we really haven't heard before. And that's troubling, particularly when each side seems to be trying to outdo the other in terms of rhetorical excess. And that's highly problematic when you've got a situation on the Korean Peninsula that is as tense as it is. When you have North Korea, which unlike 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, has some missile and nuclear capabilities that it did not have in the past, and is actually able to deliver potentially on some of the threats that it poses or the threats that it has voiced in recent days. So this is a troubling period. It's important to try to figure out a way to de-escalate this crisis. The greatest threat that we have right now is the threat of miscalculation or misperception on the part of one side or the other side. And as this rhetoric continues to escalate, it creates an almost a cycle, if you will, of increasing rhetorical excess. And that doesn't go to a good place. And so it's important to try to figure out a way to put the pause button on here.
Well, the definition of rhetorical excess can be applied to the leader of Pyongyang for many years now, or however many years he has been in power. But the difference here seems to be coming from the White House. How does that figure in? How does that escalate at all?
Well, as somebody who's been working on North Korea for a long time, I'm intimately familiar in several languages with some of the threats that they've made over the years. In the past, their practice has been when they get into a difficult place, when they're feeling weak or threatened, they engage in rhetorical overkill. But in the past, we were able to discount that because they didn't have the capabilities to actually do what they were threatening to do. But now we have a situation, as you've rightly pointed out, in which their rhetoric is being matched almost word for word with rhetoric of our own. And we have the United States, and particularly the United States president, unfortunately, acting in a fashion that previous presidents have not acted. And by using these words, by making these suggestions, by implying certain things in a way that's very uncharacteristic of presidential behavior in the past. And this has put a big question mark over developments on the Korean Peninsula because we don't know where all this is headed.
Does China still have the ability to make a difference?
I come down on the side of the debate that suggests that China could do more. It's influence over North Korea may not be as great as it once was, but I don't know of any other actor who has as much influence as China has. Despite their support for some of the Security Council resolutions, despite some of the critical comments that the Chinese have made, the Chinese, if you talk to them privately, as I have, say that they feel that excessive pressure could bring about what they regard as a nightmarish situation on the Korean Peninsula. And that situation is a collapsed or collapsing North Korean regime. That's China's nightmare. China doesn't like the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons and missiles. It doesn't like the fact that North Korea threatens to use those weapons. But what China really doesn't like is the possibility of chaos and collapse on its border. And towards that end, the Chinese have been reluctant partners in putting pressure on North Korea via sanctions. And so you have this disconnect between the United States and China about the basic tool that the United States feels is essential to convince the North Koreans to go down a different path.
Evans Revere is senior advisor to the Albright Stonebridge Group and a former senior U.S. diplomat. Evans, thanks so much for being with us here on
VOA. Thank you very much.
These are some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. U.S. dismisses North Korean declaration of war claim. Mattis hails historic opportunity to expand U.S.-India ties. China unlikely to back tougher U.N. actions against Myanmar. World Trade Organization filing, U.S. asks China not to enforce cybersecurity law. Parents of dead Ohio students speak out against North Korea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is scheduled to brief the Security Council Thursday on the violence in Myanmar's Western Rakhine State, which he has denounced as ethnic cleansing and French President Emmanuel Macron has likened to genocide. Hundreds have been killed since late August when Muslim insurgents attacked security forces in Myanmar, also known as Burma, prompting a crackdown that has forced more than 400,000 Rohingya Muslims to flee Bangladesh. At the United Nations, Myanmar Ambassador Hao Du Suan said there is no ethnic cleansing, no genocide occurring in his country.
The leaders of Myanmar, who have long been striving for freedom and human rights, will not espouse such policies. We will do everything to prevent ethnic cleansing and genocide. Myanmar objects in the strongest terms the use of such words as atrocities and ethnic cleansing by the delegations concerned in their statements in reference to the situation in Myanmar. I would like to urge these delegations and the international community as well to see the situation in Northern Rakhine objectively and in an unbiased manner.
But Human Rights Watch on Tuesday insisted that crimes against humanity have been committed by Myanmar's security forces and called for UN sanctions and an arms embargo. Freelance journalist and author Francis Wade, who wrote the book Myanmar's Enemy Within, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Security Council should insist on sending in a fact-finding mission, which he said the government is reluctant to admit.
At the moment, we're having news coming through of discoveries of the bodies of Hindus who were allegedly killed by Rohingya insurgents. And it's for these reasons that the government should really be allowing independent investigations in, because therefore they can determine what sort of crimes were committed by both the insurgents and, which the government would like to avoid, crimes by the military.
Despite the UN's term of what's going on in Rakhine State as ethnic cleansing, Myanmar UN ambassador on Monday said there is no ethnic cleansing, there is no genocide. The leaders of Myanmar, who have long been striving for freedom and human rights, will not espouse such policies. We'll do everything to prevent ethnic cleansing and genocide.
Well, I think we just have to look at the data now. We know that more than 220 villages have been burned. We know that in one township alone, 3/4 of the Muslim population has been effectively pushed out of the country, many killed, many forcibly transferred. And those crimes together do amount to a charge of ethnic cleansing. But it's very difficult to determine exactly what's happened on the ground because the government has effectively turned this area into a black site. And so information coming out of there is somewhat difficult to corroborate. Hence, we're sending fact-finding teams to Bangladesh rather than Myanmar, which is where they should be going.
How likely do you think it will be for the Myanmar government of Aung San Suu Kyi to acquiesce to demands that Rakhine State be opened up to outsiders?
She's evidently highly reluctant to do this. She said that she'd allow independent observers to visit certain places where Muslims still remain. And she wants people to look at why those people have chosen to remain. She said they're still there because they've integrated successfully into the local society, which suggests that those who have been pushed out, the nearly 500,000, don't really belong in the country. And it goes back to this idea again that, you know, there's an illegal population in Myanmar, in Western Myanmar, that haven't assimilated and therefore they shouldn't be there.
The Security Council may consider a formal statement on the situation, but China and Russia, who hold veto powers, may not agree to stronger action such as a resolution. Francis Wade said China's key interest is in protecting its economic interests in Myanmar. Happening now in Asia, authorities in Vanuatu have evacuated as many as 6,000 people from their homes because of an increasingly active volcano on the Pacific nation's northern island. The Manaro volcano has been spewing ash, fire, volcanic gas, and lava for several weeks. The volcano last erupted in 2005. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening. China is hosting the annual gathering of the Global Police Force Interpol this week in Beijing. President Xi Jinping greeted the delegates Tuesday before the opening day of the Interpol General Assembly, pledging to back Interpol's efforts to achieve global security governance. But human rights groups have questioned whether China is trying to use the France-based agency to arrest opponents of the ruling Communist Party, especially since last year's election of Chinese Vice Public Security Minister Meng Hongwei as Interpol's president. Human Rights Watch says Beijing has misused Interpol's Red Notice arrest warrant system to arrest fugitive ex-officials and business people wanted for corruption, as well as political dissidents such as Dolkan Issa, a German-based ethnic Uyghur activist. The Uyghurs are Turkish-speaking Muslims from China's western region of Xinjiang, and Beijing routinely accuses exiled Uyghur activists of supporting terrorist activities in Xinjiang. Uyghur activists have accused China of forcibly repressing Uyghur cultural and religious beliefs. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. After years of detention at one of two remote Australian-run Pacific centers, at least 22 asylum seekers are heading to the United States for permanent resettlement Tuesday. A second group of about 30 refugees is expected to leave a second detention center in the coming days. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Mount Everest is indisputably the world's highest peak, but precisely how tall is it? And did the powerful 2015 earthquake in the high Himalayas shrink the giant mountain? Nepal is setting out on an ambitious 2-year project to remeasure the peak, hoping to settle conflicting data about the famous mountain, a magnet for climbers from the world over. The project is as much about national pride. The measurements so far have come from an Indian and Chinese survey. Now tiny Nepal wants to decide the height of the Everest mountain on its own and demonstrate it does not lag behind its two giant neighbors. The mountain lies on the border between Nepal and China. Survey Department Director General Ganesh Prasad Bhatta calls the towering peak Nepal's baby.
I used to say, you know, since the birth of Mount Everest, Nepal hasn't measured it yet. What we want, you know, to uphold the, you know, national dignity that Nepal is competent to carry out any kind of challenging survey work by its own.
Although Nepal boasts 8 of the world's 14 peaks over 8,000 meters in height, it's Everest that is central to the country's economy, earning millions of dollars from climbers wanting to conquer the biggest prize. The first ever measurement of Everest was made in 1854, but the peak's widely accepted height of 8,848 meters was established a century later by an Indian survey. In 1999, an American team sponsored by Boston's Museum of Science and the National Geographic Society used satellite technology to determine a slightly taller height by 2 meters. In 2005, a Chinese mission to the peak said the rock height of the mountain was more than 5 meters lower. A dispute erupted between the two countries, China and Nepal, which has insisted that the measure of a mountain includes snow height. So officially, it has remained at 8,848 meters. An initiative to remeasure the mountain in 2012 never took off. However, questions resurfaced after a 7.8 magnitude earthquake ripped Nepal and caused massive landslides on Everest in 2015. While remaining firmly in charge of the project, Nepali officials say that they will take care to get international endorsement of the data and could permit international scientists to support them technically or even join the project.
We want to, you know, to ensure the international community that whatever has been done is done with the, you know, accurately with the standard, you know, methodology, and there shouldn't be any question about the result, whatever we produce at the end of the project.
Bhatta said his office is finalizing the methodology and a team of Sherpas equipped with measuring equipment will be dispatched to the summit in April or October next year. There are also concerns that the world's tallest peak is not immune to climate change. Climbers and locals say portions of the trail leading to the summit are turning rocky as they lose snow cover, combined with shifting geology of the young Himalayan range that is still growing. 63-year-old Aung Sharing Sherpa is a seasoned mountaineer who grew up in a village along the slopes of Everest and has planned many expeditions up its slopes.
We feel that Mount Everest is massive, solid, unchanging, strong, mighty, lofty, and unable to be hurt. But the truth is one of the most vulnerable area in the world because of the impact of climate change. The white snow peaks and glaciers are melting rapidly and retreating at an unprecedented rate.
Earlier this year, India offered to remeasure the mountain, but that raised questions in Nepal. In an editorial in the Kathmandu Post, it said, quote, "It is our property and our heritage. We have to determine the height of our property ourselves with modern technology in a way that satisfies the researchers of the world." Our thanks to Anjana Prasricha in New Delhi for scaling journalistic heights to bring us this story. This news alert from VOA Asia. The activist group Human Rights Watch Tuesday accused the Myanmar military of committing crimes against humanity as hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims flee violence in Rakhine State. The United Nations says more than 400,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled to Bangladesh. Top stories and features to share are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, mysterious black holes, thought to reside in the center of every galaxy, are difficult to study because even the closest one, in the center of our own Milky Way, is still some 27,000 light-years away. VOA's George Pudich discovered researchers at the University of Nottingham's Quantum Gravity Laboratory found that some of the physical phenomena linked to black holes can be studied in an ordinary bathtub.
Black holes form when a massive star, burning for billions of years, finally exhausts its fuel and collapses into a lump of material so dense that a teaspoon weighs about 55 billion tons. All surrounding material, stars, planets, cosmic dust, starts rotating around it, slowly being swallowed towards the point of no return, also called the event horizon. The similarity with the vortex around the plug hole in a pool filled with water is obvious.
Because we've got an analog event horizon in our system, this will give rise to the same kind of effects that you can observe around the black holes. So by creating this experimental setup here, we're actually able to study the same kind of effects that occur around black holes without having to travel to the center of the galaxy and do experiments on them.
According to the theory of super irradiance, gravitational waves entering the area just outside the event horizon emerge on the other side with more energy than they had. For obvious reasons, no one has been able to prove it experimentally, but water proved to be a suitable substitute. In this experiment, a special device creates waves on the water's surface, while a 3D camera captures what happens in the area where air interfaces with water. A real-time video of the wave pattern clearly shows the effect.
The wave is created here on the bottom. We can see it propagating, so it's a plane wave, the same everywhere. It moves, and then eventually it will hit the vortex and then interact with it. And after, we can see a scattering pattern. And a good indication for super irradiance is those discontinuity lines, because they are a sign of interferences in our system. So basically it says that something happened.
Scientists say this analogy with black holes could prompt new ideas for using Earth-bound phenomena in studying the events happening at astronomical distances. Results of this research were published in the journal Nature Physics. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
American musician Eric Alabaster loves Pakistani food, culture, speaks Urdu, and plays Desi music. VOA Diwa's Samin Asan has the story, based in Eric's music studio in Brooklyn, New York, known as Little Pakistan.
American musician Eric Alabaster was a drummer and pianist in New York. Then he met Ustad Mulazim Hussain, a Pakistani drummer who plays the tabla. For Eric, the introduction to South Asian or Desi music changed everything.
I'm a lifelong student of music, and I've been introduced to Desi music, I am sort of between two worlds, and each world is a complete world unto itself.
Not only did Eric learn to play tabla, but he was also introduced to Eastern musicians, a connection he says is very important to him.
The things that you get from friendship are universal. It doesn't matter where that person is born, what their religion is, what beliefs are. As long as you have this connection in your heart with them, that's what counts.
Eric has now worked with a number of well-known Pakistani singers. He also hosts musical gatherings every week in his music studio in Brooklyn. It's known as Eric Ki Baithak, Urdu for Eric's drawing room. He said it happened organically.
It wasn't something I planned. It was just something that happened with people coming here, because I had a music studio here and it was a place. So as our friends, Pakistani friends and Pashto friends in the community here in Brooklyn started to come here, it began to be known about in the community. It's been my privilege to be able to have this Eric Ki Baithak, and have people be able to come here as a place where we can play music together, eat food together and socialize together.
Eric believes the things that unite us are stronger than the things that divide us. And for Eric Alabaster, music is that thing. Samina Essan, VOA News, Brooklyn, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can hear us in Tainan, Taiwan on the radio at Voice of Chungrung Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University, Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who's been listening. We also say hello and thank you to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jim Harmon, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, Ira Melman, David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.